I would now like to invite Dr. Herbert Copley to come and the members of the first panel as well.
Thank you very much, Professor Straw, Principal Monroe Bloom. C'est vraiment pour moi un grand plaisir d'être ici avec vous cet après-midi. Je voudrais remercier les organisateurs de ce colloque pour avoir choisi un thème si important pour le futur de notre pays. This afternoon, we're going to talk about that first phase, that incubation and liftoff phase. What does it take to launch? What does it take and what does it mean to launch a career in diverse fields like high performance sport, like culture and the media, like technology and business? To begin, I want to let you know that I have a terrific job. Certainly this afternoon, I've got a wonderful afternoon ahead of me, being the moderator for this very talented panel. You're going to be treated to some diverse perspectives on this subject. But beyond that, in my day job, I've got what I think is a tremendous job. I have the pleasure of working with some of Canada's most talented graduate students and young researchers, people who are helping us to understand the human condition, who we are, what we think, how we behave as Canadians and as citizens of the world, and to mobilize the insights from that kind of knowledge to address some of the big challenges that Canada faces in the days ahead. It is tremendously rewarding work. It's also very optimistic. It certainly fills me with a sense of optimism about the future of our country when I see the kind of young people who are pursuing graduate studies, who are building their own talent and building their own careers. At the same time, it can be a little bit sobering. I'm constantly reminded of how challenging it can be, even for the most talented among Canadians, to build their career, to have that first entry into the workplace, to realize their talents. And it's those kind of topics that we're going to talk about this afternoon. We have, as I said, a great set of group of panelists here who are going to talk to you bring diverse perspectives from a variety of fields on this question of building talent, launching careers, launching and sustaining careers. Donc, vous ne serez pas déçus, j'en suis certain, cet après-midi avec nos panélistes. So, joining me on stage from the far right, Jean-Sébastien Condrayer. Jean-Sébastien is the co-founder and general partner of Real Ventures and Founder Fuel. He's been involved in the Canadian high-tech community since the mid-90s and continues to be as both an angel investor himself and as an advisor to technology companies. À côté de lui, somebody who I think probably needs no introduction here in Montreal, but Béatrice Martin est bien connue comme cœur de pirate. She is, of course, a Felix Award-winning singer, songwriter, and musician. Her music has sold hundreds of thousands of copies worldwide. And she's going to talk to us today particularly about perspectives from the world of the arts. Jen Heil is an Olympian and a community activist. She's a multiple world champion in mogul skiing. She was Olympic champion in 2006, silver medalist in 2010. She also is co-founder of a fascinating organization called V210, which is working to help Olympic athletes realize their full potential. And last, but certainly not least, Tamiem Pepin comes to us from the world of media. She is currently director of content and engagement with NA, a Montreal-based firm which works on public cause marketing and philanthropy. She is also a media force in her own right. I'm told that she has 10,000 Twitter followers right now, which is just a mind-boggling number for those of us who are neophytes in this kind of world. So I'm going to ask each of our panelists to take a few minutes to introduce themselves, to talk about their career and how they see this issue of talent development. And then we'll open it up to a conversation around some of my questions and some of yours from the audience. Donc, let's get started. Jean-Sébastien.
So when I was asked to take part in this panel and I saw the other names, they asked me to come and present myself. I said, well, I need to put up a slide deck because, you know, nobody knows about me compared to these people. And I actually needed 50 slides. So I'm going to run through them really, really fast. It's important to go through them because they set the stage for the way me and my partners have been trying to build the Montreal startup ecosystem. So, you know, I'm defined by some major events in my life. You know, I met my wife 22 years ago. We've been married for 16 years, my high school sweetheart. As those of you that are married in long-term relationships know, it's very hard to find someone that you can spend a lifetime with, especially when you meet them very young, because you end up growing in different directions. But we found ways to stay together. I'm also a father of five wonderful children. I had my son, my only son, when I was 23. I have four daughters now, so I feel very comfortable on that panel. I'm also a serial entrepreneur. So what that means is I've started a number of companies. As you can see, I didn't say successful serial entrepreneur, which means that I've had a lot more failures than successes. But the failures are good. Failures have helped shape who I am today. And so all these different things have sort of gotten me to come up with a few principles that I try to live my life by, and I try to communicate it by my actions and the things that I say with all the people I work with. So first thing is do something you love. Don't spend 5 minutes working on something that you're not passionate about. Don't be afraid of failure. So without failure, I wouldn't be here today. It's the most important thing in my life when you think about it. I mean, I've learned the most from my failures. Embrace transition periods. So transition brings opportunity. Treat everyone well. So you never know. When you treat someone well, that it makes that person feel like they should be treating other people as well. Find balance. So for me, I spend most of my life making decisions based on the well-being of my kids and my wife or the entrepreneurs that I work with. So for me, finding balance was to find 1 hour a day that I spend just for me. But everyone has their way. Family first. All my regrets come from times that I've not spent with family. Be human. I define that by, you know, being generous with your time, being, empathy, caring for other people. These are things that we should all do more. Be personal in yourself. So the person you'll meet today, from me, is the same person that interacts with their kids, with their friends. Be one person, but also be very open about who you are. Be vulnerable. Leave money out of it. Don't make decisions based on money. They're usually the wrong decisions. Don't sweat the small stuff. Pay attention to the things that are very important. Let the other stuff go. Tell it as you see it. Be honest with people. You know, you'll see honesty is magic. That one is, I'll have to explain it. Look for win-win outcomes. Now, coming from a business person, that's unusual to see, but we're trying to build a community in Montreal where we look for win-win outcomes. So there doesn't need to be a win-lose situation. Give more than you take. So this is another spin on the pay it forward comment, but just be generous with your time. Give. Don't ask for anything in return. And try to do something that makes the world a better place. So in 2006, I was very fortunate to meet with a few other people that share the same vision that I had to turn Montreal into a sustainable startup ecosystem. So what I mean by that, it's an environment in which visionary entrepreneurs can create great companies, but in a sustainable way. So every year, a great company comes out of the ecosystem. So what are the characteristics of a sustainable startup ecosystem? Again, we're talking about the technology sector. So value-add financing available at all stages, which means that people that can help the entrepreneur build their business have money to invest in the company at all stages, starting from the seed level, where they just have an idea, to the time when their business is starting to scale. Mentoring is people that have been there before offering their time for free. Engineering and business talent. a vibrant community of entrepreneurs. So other people going through the same things that the entrepreneur is going through that are willing to help. A local customer and partner base. So people like, basically companies that the entrepreneurs can sell to. Access to networks and local successes. So other companies that have succeeded in the ecosystem. Obviously, collaboration. So all these people working together to help each other succeed. Silicon Valley is the number one startup ecosystem in the world. So what did we do? In 2008, we launched a seed fund called Montreal Startup, a $5 million fund to invest in entrepreneurs at the earliest of stages. We met with over 300 entrepreneurs, invested in 15 projects. We've had our first success, a company called Beyond the Rack, which is the largest independent e-commerce company in Canada. Over 350 employees, 60 million funding, 180 million revenue in 2012. Two guys started that company in 2009 with a PowerPoint. Other companies are progressing really well. We've helped structure and sponsor many startup events to stimulate the community. 2010, we raised a bigger fund, Real Ventures, $50 million, to execute on the same strategy. Met with over 1,500 entrepreneurs since then. So you see the increase. The community is starting to build itself. Real has invested $50 million, 40 projects, a lot of great companies on the way. 2011, we launched an accelerator program called Founder Fuel, which is a platform to help mentors interact with startups at a very early stage. That program has funded 28 new companies over the past 3 years at $25,000 to $50,000 at a pop. There's also been a great increase in activity in the ecosystem. Events, we're talking about events that are now seeing 700 plus people from the community showing up to them. 2012, we helped support the launch of a gaming incubator, so very similar to Founder Fuel before the gaming sector. So I'm a firm believer that this type of program works for many different types of industries. We're also very involved in the Nutman House Project, which is a community project. Over, I think, 1,500 or 1,000 people invested in it. It's a, basically, it will become the center for entrepreneurship for the web and software in Montreal. A great partnership with the local governments, Vidéotron is a partner, and a few other entities. And so since 2011, over 10,000 people have visited the house. Over 50 startups have been created out of it. So I'm a co-founder of these entities. You know, when people ask me what I do, I help build startup ecosystems. I also help entrepreneurs succeed. And what we do, we like to think of our platform as sustainable venture capital. That's it.
Great. Well, that's, I think, a tremendous start to our conversation. Beatrice, why don't I ask you to share a few words about your background. And
I'm going to do that. I mean, after that, I have no idea. I'm going to present myself.
I'm a little sidestep by that as well.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
My name is Beatrice, Beatrice Martin. I'm 23. I'm a singer-songwriter. I'm based in Montreal. I've worked in Paris as well because I sing in French. I started my career in 2008, had a little demo up on this website called MySpace that is no longer with us today, and suddenly I got a record deal out of basically nothing. I remember having a pep talk with my now manager about it all, and he told me that he wanted to release a record, and I thought he was crazy, and I thought to myself, okay, maybe I'll sell 50 records and I can still go to school and do my thing, and maybe I'll play like in front of, like, I don't know, 120 people and still go to my classes. But then I started selling 1,000 records a week, and I had to drop out of school, and I started my career. Don't worry, guys, I still went back to stage up afterwards and finished it off, but, you know, it was really intense, and things just happened so fast and so quickly. And I feel blessed because I can still do this today, but it's based on a lot of luck and a lot of hard work. And I didn't stop until today because I became a mom. It's just so great. I'm so happy to be here. I have no idea what I'm going to talk about, but I'm just really happy to be here, guys. Thank you. Thank you. That's me.
Beatrice may say she doesn't know what she wants, what we're going to talk about, but she's got a great story to tell. I'm absolutely certain. So we'll hear more about that in a few minutes. And I think, you know, those themes of that constellation of good luck and a ton of hard work is going to come through in all of the stories that we're going to hear this afternoon and the things we're going to talk about over the next 2 days. Jennifer, do you want to tell us a little bit about your background and how you see this issue of development of talent?
Yeah, sure. Well, to start off, like Beatrice, I've actually been a dropout in and out of university for 10 years now, leaving and coming back, going to the slopes, coming back, and I'm almost graduated. That will occur in April, so that's going to be exciting. But when Professor Straw invited me to be a part of this conference, I was thrilled because I realized I've loved the idea of innovation and how to become better. I've been obsessed with this topic since I was, in fact, 9 years old. And, of course, I didn't recognize that as a 9-year old, that's what I was, why I was being propelled towards the Olympic Games. But when I was 9 years old, I got a hold of a magazine, and it was filled with images of Olympic athletes. And I was just drawn to these athletes. They were midair, their bodies were carving through space. You could see the determination in their eyes. And I knew that that was something I wanted to do. So right then and there, at 9 years old, I decided that I was going to go to the Olympics. And I just had to determine in what sport. So as you said, there is a lot of luck involved for sport in Canada, and I would argue that there's actually too much of luck involved, because I wanted to be a swimmer, and I maxed out my height at 5'3", and quickly realized that that just wasn't going to happen. And fortunately, I was surrounded with individuals who recognized that swimming probably wasn't the sport best suited to me. And my father came across a poster of freestyle skiing in a mall on a bulletin board. And he said, I just saw this cool new sport, it's called mogul skiing. Never heard of it. He said, well, would you like to try it? Sure. So in Edmonton, I went out and started skiing on these little tiny hills and ended up going all the way to the Olympics in this sport. So coming back to the theme of how talent is developed in Canada, I would argue that we don't have a systematic approach to developing talent and identifying talent on the sports side. There's definitely a lot more that we need to do. Canada is traditionally a very great innovator, so we come to new sports, we adopt new Olympic winter sports, we're at the top of our game. We can see that, well, we'll probably see that in Sochi at the next Olympics with slopestyle, halfpipe. These are new sports entering the Olympics. We're expected to win a lot of medals, but the issue is we can't hold on to that advantage, and we let other countries surpass us. They become more innovative, and we then start to play catch up. So there's a lot that we have to take a look at, and I would argue that this is a very important topic, sport in Canada. Obviously, there's no other event in Canada, I would argue, that brings our country together like sport. And you know, being in Vancouver, walking down Robson Street, high-fiving Canadians for 2 weeks, singing O Canada in the streets with random strangers. It was an incredible moment, and I'm sure you'll all agree with that. But on an even bigger issue, we have an inactivity crisis in our country. We know that our sport participation numbers are getting smaller, not bigger. And so we need to come together and get a comprehensive look of how we can develop our talent, how we can identify talent, how we can keep kids interested in sport. And university has a place to play in that and a role to play in that ecosystem to leverage each other's goals and to really create a comprehensive system from grassroots to Olympic level.
Great. Thanks very much, Jen. Tammy, do you want to tell us a little bit about your story? You've got a different route here, right?
Yes. Is this my... Yes, okay. Hold on. We got this. Okay, so my name is Tammy. I'm very happy to be here. It actually means a lot to me because I graduated from McGill University not too long ago, so this feels very special.
I actually studied in cultural studies. I was always passionate about media and communication, and I wasn't quite sure at the time. I remember actually switching programs during those first 2 weeks of school. I wasn't sure exactly where to go or how I would get where I wanted to be. And then once I graduated, a great thing happened, and that was social media. I knew I wanted to work in television. I knew I wanted to work in media, but I was knocking at the door of all these production companies and traditional media outlets, and they were telling me, well, what's your experience? Oh, we can't hire you. And then I saw these great tools that were completely free, and I thought, this is my opportunity to become my own media and to broadcast myself, my ideas, what I'm passionate about. And that's exactly what happened. I think, you know, we were talking about luck earlier. Timing for me was really important. I got there at a time where everybody was rushing to try to understand this whole social media thing, whether it's businesses, advertising companies, brands, newspapers. And then I got hired by an advertising agency that you might know in Montreal called Sidley. They were doing, this was in 2008, 2009, they were doing a campaign for Tourism Montreal, which was quite innovative at the time. It was 100% web-based, and it was all content. So they dropped off all traditional advertisement, and they decided to hire bloggers and people who could do video and who could write articles and who could do photography and connect with travelers online. Because when you go somewhere and you travel, I don't know about you, but I go on Google and I'll type my destination, I'm going to look at reviews, I'm going to try to find people that I like on social media that share the same interests, and then I'll be guided, and that's how I'm going to build my trip. So I worked with them for 2 years on that campaign. And that's how I got known in Quebec and built a community on Twitter and on Facebook and on other platforms. From there, I started working in television through the Québécois network. So I was in with TVA, Vox, and sometimes on the news at SN talking about topics related to the internet and angles of the news stories as seen through social media. And from there, I stayed with the Québécois family, went on to work at Journal de Montréal. And after that, I decided to go with the Huffington Post. I always admired the Huffington Post because they really had that DNA of community and engagement. And I really thought, like, they understand where media is going, and they're not this big dinosaur that just refuses to use these platforms and these tools to connect with people and to reinvent the news. So when I heard I was actually working for Journal de Montréal, covering a conference that Arianna Huffington was giving in Quebec, and that's where she announced, it was like, next year we're going to launch an edition in Quebec, and I was like, well, that's interesting. And so later I ended up working as an editor for the launch of the Huffington Post. So I was there for a year. It was extremely successful. And just now I decided to go back to freelancing because I want to be working on different projects. And one of the things that I always felt was missing was purpose. Like, we do all these things, and I work in the media world, but sometimes there were stories that just made me uncomfortable, and I felt that we were doing for the wrong reasons, that we were doing for clicks and for impressions, and it just left a kind of void in my life. So two of the people who actually created the Tourism Montreal campaign for Tourism Montreal for Sidley decided to leave 2 years ago and found their own agency. It's Nathaniel Schachter and Annick Decosse. Their agency is called NA. And they decided to start an agency that was going to be specialized in corporate social responsibility and good marketing. So I wanted to talk to you a bit about that and what we were doing. So basically, we're trying to focus. I work with them as director of content. So we're trying to focus on connecting brands and consumers and nonprofits to create good marketing. So what is that? We hear a lot of people nowadays that are demanding that brands do good and that, you know, they stop being reckless with the planet and that they start, you know, caring about people and caring about the world. And what I feel is that there's a lot of people in these businesses and these brands, I feel like they think that it's a fad and that it's going to go away. So they do these cause marketing campaigns where they'll associate themselves with a cause for a little while, but there's no real commitment. So what we're working on is really trying to create campaigns that really put cause and good at the core of the DNA of a brand. So that's what I'm working on right now. And you know, I think with social media, people are more connected, and they're just going to keep being more hyper-connected, whether it's on mobile, walking in the street. And this exchange of ideas is putting a lot of pressure on companies to do good, and they can't bullshit consumers anymore because they see right through it, and they will destroy the company on Twitter, and they will destroy it on Facebook. So it's really important, I think, to go in that direction. And last but not least, I'm also focusing on my television career. So I'm in new media, but I'm also in traditional media. Right now I'm working on a show with CNN. I'm working behind the camera on this show. I had the chance to work with Anthony Bourdain, whom you might know is a chef in the United States. He's a great traveler and extremely down-to-earth. He's been on the Travel Channel for years. And we've had the chance to work on shows in the past together, and now he's going to be doing a show for CNN, so we're starting production this week. I'm very excited. It's going to be an hour show showcasing Quebec, and that's going to be on CNN in the spring of 2013, so I'm really looking forward to seeing their response to that. That's it.
So as advertised, you know, a really diverse set of perspectives here, fascinating experiences. Jennifer maybe put her finger on the tough question in all of this. I mean, are we doing a good enough job in Canada at identifying and developing talent? And maybe one way of getting at that, I wonder if I could ask each of you, I mean, how does that happen in your fields? How are promising newcomers identified? Jean-Sébastien, in the business world, in the tech area,
so,
tech startups?
You know, we work in the technology sector mostly. So in our field, the way it works is you know, usually the people that want to become successful in our world want to start companies. So it's very important to give them the platform to do that. And as they start companies, that they start companies that will have an impact on the world as opposed to just a business that will help feed their, you know, their family. So, and the way you do that is you need to have other people in the ecosystem that are willing to give time and meet with these entrepreneurs and tell them that it's possible here in Montreal or in Quebec or Canada to build a great company. And then you need the ecosystem to support it. So you need, like I mentioned earlier, access to capital at all stages. So, you know, one thing that had been missing in Canada was capital at the very early stages. So these entrepreneurs that have great ideas, they go, they meet with potential investors, and everyone turns them down. Now, there's been a huge change in the tech sector over the past 5 years where that capital is now available at the seed level. So, you know, we have Real Ventures that does it here, but then there's other funds in other places in the rest of Canada that are funding some of these entrepreneurs, and basically telling them go, you know, try to build a great company as opposed to try to generate revenue really quickly. What you also need is collaboration. I think that's a really key component. Is, you know, yes, the business world is very competitive, like sports, but it's extremely important that the people that are part of the ecosystem, the ones that have been successful, the ones that are trying to become successful today, help each other in their quest to build great companies.
Right. And Beatrice, I mean, in the arts, you know, who identifies? How were you identified? I mean, essentially, it was the public recognized you, correct?
There are many ways to actually find success in the music world. I mean, just with the basic concours. So I mean, like, just if you sign up for Canadian Idol or Star Academy, and that's the public approach to it. And then there are different approaches, such as the web now, which is great, which is what I did. Also playing a lot of shows and touring. I mean, the most traditional approach would be touring a lot. And if you play a lot of shows, then eventually somebody will find you and recognize that you're talented and release a record. But I mean, in my case, what I found was really interesting, if you don't want to be successful, that's when success finds you. I thought that people that wanted to release records had to automatically do some kind of contest, such as, you know, Canadian Idol Track Academy and everything. And I remember when I first got that record deal, I thought, well, that will never work. It'll never work. And I mean, afterwards, I started playing shows, and that's when everything kind of clicks through. But right now, today, I guess the best way to get yourself out there is the internet. It can ruin you as a musician, but it can also make you what you are. So, I mean, that's the first step.
It strikes me when I hear all of you talk that a big part of this as well is sort of recognizing yourself as a success, seeing yourself in that role. I mean, Jen, you talked about, you know, setting your goal first of all as being an Olympian and then picking the sport after that, which seems like the opposite way that most of us would think you go about this. But so, I mean, is there that point in your the early stage of your career when you know, things click in place where you realize, oh, this may actually work as a future for me, as a career?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure there was one specific moment. I mean, I can remember having to go off a jump for the first time and being terrified. And so I wasn't like, oh, I'm going to the Olympics in that moment. But no, I mean, definitely having the belief in yourself, that's very important, because, as I said, the pathway that we have identified or that we don't have for athletes is not a clear pathway from, you know, entering sport to getting to the Olympics. So I think the most important thing that you have to arm yourself with is that belief, because you have to create a pathway and you have to be willing. I've been on many pathways and I've had to switch directions and try another angle when it didn't work. You know, the first example being a swimmer and switching to skiing, that's only one example. So without that belief, then there's no way that I could have continued down the road and, you know, made it to the end game. But I don't think my story is unique, and that's what I think is what is most important about this, is that, you know, most of the Olympians I know, most of the Olympic athletes who hit the podium, they have very similar stories where they didn't start off in their sport. Some random event led them to a different event, and they feel very lucky that they were able to make it. So there definitely is a lot that needs to be discussed around how do we identify talent and how do we develop talent in the sports system. And there's a lot of controversy around the word talent itself, and can talent be developed, or is it innate? I tend to think that it can be developed personally, and it does need to be nurtured. But there's a whole range of systems of what goes on out there, you know, from China that has a very structured approach that wouldn't work in a culture like Canada, to other countries like Britain, who they credit a lot of their success at the Olympic Games because in London, because they went out and they identified talent, they had a semi-truck that they drove across the country with bikes in the back and said, does anybody want to get on this bike and see how strong you are? And if you were strong enough, then they'd say, all right, you're on the team. Let's try and get you to the Olympic Games. So nothing like that is happening. And as I said, it's very haphazard. It's very circumstantial on how we get there in Canada.
Well, but it's not just that sort of 10,000 hours approach that, I mean, obviously there has to be that innate ability in these individuals to start with.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it comes to the end of the day, you have to have the basic resource, the basic tools to be able to do your sport. You have to have the basic physical capacity. I didn't have the physical capacity to be a swimmer, but I did a skier. So it comes down to that. And then it is the 10,000 hours. I firmly believe that's what it takes to nurture talent.
And Tammy, in your field, I mean, is it as structured as sport, where there are people looking for talent all the time, or is it more, even more haphazard?
I think people are looking for talent. There's definitely, now you've seen, there's people in LA who are focused on just finding talent on YouTube, for example. So they're looking for kids that are putting out videos that have crazy engagement, that have a lot of views, that can build a community. So there's this whole thing, you know, that is coming out of the internet. But just like Jennifer was talking about, for me, I always knew I was going to succeed. It was not a debate. It was not, I didn't know how, and I didn't know the path, and that's okay too, because when I was in school, I would have never known where technology would have gone. So, you know, if I would have prepared for something, I would have ended up changing that. So I feel like it's kind of similar to what you were saying earlier.
And that role of mentoring, I mean, you've all mentioned it in different ways, how important coaches and mentors are. Do you see yourselves now as mentors and coaches for others, Beatrice? I mean, are you working with other artists in terms of helping to launch their careers as well?
I mean, I wish it'll happen. It'll probably happen in time. I'm too young in my career right now to actually, you know, be able to have the credibility to mentor people. But I like to think that, I mean, especially with this year at the ADISC, I won an award, which was a female interpreter of the year. That is usually never won by a singer-songwriter like me. I don't have that kind of voice. To win that prize, I think it really opened something for other singer-songwriters out there, to women, to young girls that are probably, you know, too scared to put stuff up because they're like, maybe I haven't lived enough. And that was really great for me. I was really glad just for that.
Nice. And Jean-Sébastien, clearly you see that as part of your role, but not just the coaching directly, but creating the infrastructure, the ecosystem, as you said.
I mean, I do mentoring all day long. That's all I do, coaching and mentoring. I don't run businesses anymore. I just help other people with their businesses. But that doesn't scale, which is why, you know, we got together as a group to build a platform that makes it easier for other people who do want to help, maybe not in a full-time way like I do, but to still do that and to give their time in the project, that the projects and the entrepreneurs that deserve it. And that's why you know we can go from, you know, 300 entrepreneurs getting supported a few years ago to now 1500, to now, you know, we run mentor days with entrepreneurs where we have over 100 people show up. These are all very qualified, successful people that come in and will give a day of their time to entrepreneurs, and then accept to spend an hour a week with them for a 3-month period, for no pay whatsoever, just to be involved with this new generation of entrepreneurs.
Fascinating, Jen. I mean, does that compare in sport? I mean, your organization V210 is trying to create some of that same sense of an ecosystem that would support high performance athletes.
Yeah, exactly. I think mentorship is critical. For me, it took my coach identifying that I did have the talent, even though I had chronic injuries. I couldn't ski a full run from top to bottom at 18 years old. My body was so broken down. I had just finished my first Olympic Games fourth by 1/100th of a point, the smallest margin possible to miss a medal by, and I was really lost. And so having somebody come to me and help me develop a plan and help me get on the road to develop, I basically went back to the beginning and rebuilt. So I learned how to walk again. I learned how to move again. I basically went back to the beginning of the pathway of what I should have been doing when I was 9 years old or 12 years old and started again. And so I came through that system. I took a year off from competitive skiing. And when I came back, I started to have the tools I needed. So I could ski faster. I could jump higher because I had gone to the core of my weakness and redefined that approach. And so 4 years later, when I was in Torino, I stood on top of the mountain at the 2006 Olympics, and I knew I was 100% prepared. I knew I had everything I needed, and it was the most rewarding moment of my life. I hadn't even pushed out of the start gate. There was no Olympic medals that had been rewarded, but knowing that I had done everything, knowing that I had come through an environment where I could train and prepare without compromise, was the greatest gift I had ever been given. And that was supported through business leaders here in Montreal who believed in my dream, who made donations so I could train in that environment. And so at the end of the day, and you know, being able to create success in that matter, we looked at each other, my coach and one of my mentors, and we said, well, why am I the only athlete in Canada who can train without compromise, who can have the tools that they need to succeed. And so that was the spirit of where B210 was launched. And so really the idea is to identify the needs of an athlete on an individual approach. So that's something we're still not really comfortable doing in Canada, especially in the sports system. We're very shy to look at a team of individuals because we think that that may be putting somebody down if we're giving somebody something else. But in fact, what we're doing is elevating everybody because we're giving people what they need, their deficiencies, targeting what their deficiency is. So in the sports world, that could mean anything from extra hours with a psychologist, a nutritionist, having one-on-one time training with a trainer. It's very simple what we need to do, but we need to do it in a systematic approach. So that's been our objective with B210. We have a mandate till 2016. We're supporting about 40 different athletes right now. We had some great success in London, some great success in Vancouver, and I think most importantly, we want to show that you can, with the help and support of the business leaders, that you can change the approach and that you can do more and be more efficient and be more purposeful on less.
Terrific. And Tammy, to you, I mean, is there that sort of mentorship that exists in the social media space?
I think in the media space, it can be a bit complicated because it's so competitive when you start out. You feel like you're in competition with everybody. And the other thing is that if you're young, today I have mentors and I'm so thankful I've learned so much through this. But when you're starting, you feel a bit shy to go ask somebody who's a media personality to take some of their time for you to answer your questions and to guide you. But actually, Andy Nauman, who is going to be a speaker here at some point this week, I emailed Andy and I asked him, I was like, one of my friends, Julian, gave me the homework. He was like, this week you have a week to reach out to 5 people that you're going to go sit down with and you're going to talk to them and you're going to ask them, how did they become successful? What are the biggest things that they've learned? And you're going to learn from that and you're going to build a relationship with those people. And so sometimes you just have to do it and send an email to somebody you do not know. And today, I love Andy. I knew who he was. But today, we're friends, and I've learned a lot from him. And the great thing about social media is that maybe back in the day, you admired a personality, but it was very difficult to get in touch with them, or you had to go through their agent or this and that. But today, you can just find them on Facebook or on Twitter, or you can find their email address. And if you have the right approach, then they will take the time. I was incredibly surprised by how generous people in the field of communication and journalism actually are. And, you know, I also feel that maybe some younger bloggers might feel like, oh, this old traditional media. But at the end of the day, a blog is only a platform. Journalism stays journalism, and you can learn from these people who have been doing it for years and decades. So I think that mentorship is definitely incredibly important, but in my field, it's really something that you need to take and do yourself.
Great. Yeah, and I think, we're hearing that from everyone. Yes, there are structures around you to help support, but a lot of it is that individual responsibility.
You have to be determined. Have to be determined for success. If you want it, you will go out of your way and you will do the research and you will do your homework and you will do what you have to do. But it's not going to fall from the sky, and no mentor is going to come up to you and tell you, you have to go get what's yours and be determined to succeed. I think that's what people who success all have in common.
Great. Why don't we open it up to questions from the audience? Do people have questions that you'd like to pose to one or all of our panelists? N'hésitez pas de poser vos questions dans n'importe quelle des langues officielles. Pose your questions in either official language. But why don't we begin back here and then in the second row? So, go ahead.
En montrant vraiment des côtés éthiques et personnels, et en montrant que vraiment le succès passe par là. Je trouve que c'est... parce que être successful in business, c'est une chose, mais être successful in business avec une éthique et des valeurs, c'est pas la même chose. Et j'admire ça. Donc, vraiment, félicitations. En fait, donc pour venir à ma question, je voudrais vous demander how do you deal with failure? Je ne veux pas être pessimiste, je ne suis pas du tout une personne pessimiste, mais j'imagine qu'au début de vos carrières, il y a toujours ce moment où vous investissez toute votre énergie, votre temps, votre argent que vous n'avez pas encore, et que tout tombe comme votre toast full of jam le matin. Là. Et je voudrais savoir vos expériences personnelles à ce sujet. Merci.
Merci. Est-ce qu'il y a quelqu'un qui veut aborder ce sujet-là?
I can talk about failure.
Okay.
So for me, failure is a way to start over with a clean slate. So when you can call something a failure, it means that you've tried everything, it hasn't worked. And if you look ahead, you have a white page and you can reinvent yourself. So, I've had these moments many times in my life. I mean, now I invest in many companies at the same time. So I experience failure through the entrepreneurs that I invest in regularly. At the stage we invest in a startup, 50% of the companies will not make it. So failure is part of what we do. But we help the entrepreneurs cope with it. And I think what's important to do, especially for us in our field, and I don't know about the sports or music, but we tell entrepreneurs every day, don't be afraid to fail. We've invested in entrepreneurs that have failed many times, and it's also to be open and talk about the failure. So I did, I went on stage today and I talked about my failures. I'm doing another event later tonight with entrepreneurs from McGill and students and whatnot. And I'm actually going to go deep into some of the failures that I've had, discussing those in detail. And it's by discussing failure, not be afraid to talk about it, that we demystify it and make it acceptable.
I've also had many failures. When I started in the media world, I would watch my favorite channels and I would wait for the end of the broadcast to see which production company was producing what, and then the next day I would call them and I would ask for interviews, and then you would meet people and they would say no. And even later in my career, I've auditioned for many, many gigs that I did not get that I really, really wanted. And for sure it's always a disappointment because you want it so bad at one point in your life, but you just need to keep going. And I think, failure is exactly like Jess was saying, is how you learn, and you learn from your mistakes. So I think you just need to, to accept the failure and keep pushing and keep continuing and knocking on doors until, the right opportunity arises and it works out.
Who say that they've never failed, mm-hmm. They have. Everyone does.
Thank
so you don't have to worry about
it. I don't know if you've seen that. There's this photo on Facebook of all great people and their failures. Like Michael Jordan didn't make the team, and even Steve Jobs. And there's still everybody, the most successful, iconic, famous people that we know today that we say are super successful have all had incredible failures in their lives.
Yeah, I think what JS said, embracing failure, it's a hard thing to do, and I spent probably the first half of my career terrified of failure, and it would just lock me up, and I was so terrified to fail. And in being in mogul skiing, it's a sport where you have to perform without abandon. You can't have 1% of fear, or you're not going to make it down, and likely you're going to crash. And like JS said, when I got to a point where I could embrace failure, and I could be okay with the possibility of failure, that really opened me up to my best performances, and those were my greatest learning moments. I mean, finishing fourth by 1/100th of a point could be said to be a failure, but I took that as an experience, and I took that as my launching pad, and I am so happy I missed that podium in 2002 because it changed my career, it changed my trajectory, and I don't think I would have been here and had the success without that major failure.
Beatrice, anything to add?
Oh yeah, it's funny because in the music industry they prep you for failure. We don't sell as many records as we used to, and I remember when I first signed with my first major label contract in France, and they told me, if we sell 20,000 records, it's going to be fine for they're probably I don't know, they're there are a lot of people that speak French in France, and usually they used to sell a lot of records. People used to sell like a million records at least, and you know, they really told me, like, it's okay. You know, you're probably not going to make it. It's fine. And then when it happens, it's really great. But it was hard for me because I was like, wow. And then I'm going to come back to Quebec, and maybe people are going to be like, she didn't make it. She didn't do anything there. And wow, that's just ridiculous. So I was ready to fail. And yeah, I mean, I remember playing shows in front of, I don't know, 20 people when I first started out, and it was the worst. And you travel in like a car to, I don't know, the end of times, like northern Quebec. And I remember being 19 and feeling like, wow, this is the worst. I can't believe I signed up to do this. And it's hard, but you know, at least I kept on going, and now I can actually do this for a living. So.
Great. And now the people are going to get in their cars and travel to the far ends of
Quebec. And hope 20 people come.
We had a question in the second row here. Yes, go ahead. Just wait for the microphone if you could.
Hi to everybody. I just want to say off behalf of Riverdale High School, thank you to McGill University for inviting us here. We're very grateful. My question was to Mrs. Hale in particular, but I'm sure it applies to everybody. How do we get to the big leagues, like the Olympic Games? How does one achieve that level, you know, like get into it?
Yeah, well, there unfortunately isn't an easy answer to that, but I think what we talked about earlier and what Tammy also talked about is it's being very stubborn, and it's having the idea that you're going to get there and you're going to come up against roadblocks, and there's going to be some days where you have no idea how you're going to get around them, but you find a creative way, you rely on other people. I've relied and had the most incredible team behind me my entire career, and I've never been afraid to ask for help. I've never been afraid to say, I don't know how to do this, and try and find, you know, the very best who can help me. So I'd say the most important thing is being very stubborn, and the other thing is to always bring joy. And looking back at my career, my best performances, I might have been terrified, I might have been nervous, I might have had a 37-degree slope to get down, but if I felt joy and if I could embrace that moment and cherish it as an opportunity, then I could always get through. And I realize that that's as important in life as it is in sport or whatever you're doing.
How many hours a week were you, a day were you spending on becoming a...
Oh, but it was fun. It was all-encompassing, but it was fun. But yeah, before the 2010 Olympics, it was three times a day workouts, plus sports psychology.
Yeah, so like
plus
10 hours a day?
Yeah.
Easily, yeah.
Yeah, but it was, you know how it is.
Oh, yeah,
it's your passion, you don't see the time go by. Yeah. It was a privilege.
I think there was a question down at the far end. The gentleman in the black shirt.
This question is for anyone. Can you describe what it feels like to fulfill your destiny? What it feels like? Does it make you happy? Can you describe that feeling to the people that are here? Thank you.
Just so intense.
Yeah. I can answer for myself. I mean, for me, happiness is it's not something you achieve. It's sort of a state of mind. Like you get to, I mean, and going back to my PowerPoint, the balance is you find this setting in which, you know, you love what you do, and you've got people that you love and that love you back that are part of your life, and you just keep going, and you know, you feel you're contributing to the rest of the world. I mean, for me, being happy is not thinking about me; it's thinking about others. So my wife, my kids, my friends, the entrepreneurs I work with. That's sort of my formula.
Anyone else? Want to tackle the tough question?
I liked realizing that I was fulfilling a dream that I thought I never had. I had all those capacities. I knew how to play piano. I went to the conservatory, started playing piano when I was 3, and I hated piano and music, and all of a sudden I dropped out of it all, and then I found out that I could actually write songs, and then actually people liked it. So then I find this job, and I realize, wow, I actually have this thing going for me, and I actually really, really love it, and I can do this, and people are happy when I do it, so this is just great. And I guess I kind of live that every day now, and then you become a parent, and then things kind of change. Then playing music is not so much of a fulfilling your destiny kind of thing. But I feel so grateful, and it's amazing, and I really do hope that everyone can find their way, even if it's, you know, not if you're studying in something right now today and you're happy in doing that, but even if you find that like 5 years from now, that's good too.
Will, you had to.
Yeah, I don't want to.
Oh, go ahead.
Hi, Will Stroud. In fact, if we could ask people to identify themselves when they answer. For all of you, what's one thing that public funds or public support or any level of government in Canada could do to make it easier in your field for you or for others who are following behind you?
Teddy, do you want to try that one out?
What can public funds do to support people in social media? I'm not quite sure. I'm not quite sure what public people can do to support social media. I think private, I can definitely think of a lot of things. I'm sorry, I don't know.
On the sports side, there's a lot of discussion over, you know, we need more funding, but we hear that everywhere. We hear that in every sector of society, and that's not something that's going to change anytime soon. So I think our biggest focus on sport right now in Canada needs to be about efficiency. It needs to have a more purposeful approach. We need to make the system more lean. We need to coordinate it. We need to coordinate it from national sports organizations. We need the government to take a larger leadership role. We don't have a minister of sport. We need a minister of sport because I think that says to Canadians that we value sport. We need sport in this country more than ever, you know, to get our kids active, to overcome this obesity crisis. So I think the focus really has to be on, as I said, efficiency and purposefulness within the system.
Oh, well, we're a culture, so that's another story. When it comes to music, we're lucky because in Quebec we still have some sort of funding. I know even for music videos, we need funding now more than ever because, we're not really selling records anymore. And so it's, you know, we try to get our money wherever we can. But obviously, when we do get help from the government, I know I have for my records and also for my music videos. I've applied for grants, and that's been a lot of help. But I have to do that now, and a lot of musicians have to do that because otherwise we can't live from it. So yeah.
So in our case, the government is actually a big investor in the venture capital community. So the way our business works is, we raise money from governments and pension funds and individuals, and then we invest it in entrepreneurs and their companies and help them grow. In our case, our first fund, Montreal Startup, and our second fund, Real Ventures, would not have been possible without the support of the government. But the government is an investor like anyone else, so we'll profit as we're making profits. I think the way the government can play a bigger role is in continue supporting endeavors like what we're doing at the Real Ventures, which is what I call sustainable venture capital, where we use the fund as the business model to fund all these community building activities that support the entire ecosystem, not just us, but all the other investors in our field. Another way is to take away some of the capital that's put into some of the large corporations in tech in Canada, and put that capital back into supporting new entrepreneurs, new businesses.
Great. Right in the middle here, and then at the back next.
This question goes to Jennifer. Were you always at the top, like
or did you start when people were already far into the sport?
Yeah, I started the sport very young. So I started skiing when I was 2 years old. I think to this day I'm probably better on skis than I am walking. And then I started freestyle when I was 9 years old. So I had an older sister, and I got to chase her all the time. So that definitely helped. But if your question is, was I always ahead of the competition? No. And as I said, in 2002, I was very injured. I couldn't do a full run. I had to visualize before a competition because I was in so much pain physically. So my competitors were getting very far ahead at that stage. And then in 2003, the rules changed. So we'd be disqualified if we did a flip. And then in 2003, you had to do a flip to win. And I couldn't even do a flip on a trampoline. And I had a lot of fear to learn this trick. So I had to catch up to my competitors. And then the longer I stayed in the sport, those competitors and the younger ones started to flip. So I had to work very hard to stay competitive throughout my entire career and put that aside and try and focus on what I could do to keep getting better and just focus on the moment.
And in the back row, gentlemen in the back row. I think we've got time for about one or two more questions. So if you have something on your mind, put up your hand now.
Thanks. My name's Matt Zimbel. I have a question for Beatrice, because when your first album came out, I was the vice president of Musimax, and I remember getting the record and looking at it and going and listening to it and thinking, this is a lovely singer-songwriter album that will not be a commercial success.
Well, joke's
talk
on
about
you.
Failure.
I don't know. Yeah.
My
okay.
Failure. But can you reflect a little bit on what happened when the record went to France? Because if I recall correctly, the first record was kind of a very cult record here in Quebec, and it wasn't selling a lot. It wasn't on the radio necessarily. It was being played on video here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the record went to France, it kind of blew up in France to the point where I heard from friends of mine who work over there that Universal was waiting for your second album with great anticipation because that was the only way they were going to be able to be a profitable company that year in France. Can you reflect a little bit on what happens when a record goes outside of the territory and how it affects your life back in the territory where you live and where you record and
yeah.
where you create?
It's funny because a lot of people from Canada, from Quebec, that sing in French, go to France to actually find success there. There's more people that speak French, so obviously your chances of success are greater. When it happened to me, it was a shock because this one song that was on my first record found its way to the biggest radio stations in France, was having a major airplay, and I won the Victoire for Song of the Year that year, and that was unexpected. And all of a sudden, people started waking up here, and they were like, who is this girl? Is she, like, French or something? And they realized I was actually from Montreal. So anyway, so that happened, and then Quebec followed, and I started selling records here. And my biggest commercial success actually happened with the second record here, and it followed in France. But it was a very particular experience for me. To have all these people reject my songs here and to find out that people had a different approach to music in Quebec as opposed to France. But it is what it is, and now I'm very happy. I feel very blessed because I can actually continue my career. I can sing in French up in France, in Quebec, also in English Canada, and in the United States. And people in Quebec are like, wow, this is crazy. And I'm like, yeah, well, I mean, I'm still doing this. I'm still saying that I'm from Quebec, and it's great. And it's a funny little story how that turned out.
But you're one of those rare cases. Your success was international, really, before it was domestic.
It happened with Simple Plan as well.
Yeah.
They had this huge success in the rest of the world. And here it was like, wow, these guys are singing in English. That's just weird. But they're from Laval. What's going on? And it's really funny how this province works sometimes.
Okay,
I still love it,
that's another conversation.
Yeah.
We've got a question in the back row, and then I'm afraid we're going to probably have to wrap it up.
All right, thanks. My name is Harold Murphy. I was in London this summer. My daughter was on the Canadian basketball team. And I'd like to talk about the incubation section here that we're addressing. One thing in particular, I've noticed that only one of you people on the panel mentioned your parents. Mike Farber wrote an article this summer about that this is the Parents' Olympics. And from a parent's point of view, I got to say in Canada, it really is serendipitous how you're able to get your child to be able to get to the right place at the right time, to ask the right questions, to be on the national teams. It's very difficult for parents because we really don't have a lot of information that helps us advise and guide and make the right decisions. Do you go to the NCAA? Which conference do you play in? Who's a good coach? Who isn't a good coach? How do you get connected to the Canadian team? All these things are very difficult for parents because we really don't have a lot of information to help and advise and guide our people to do that. So maybe, Jennifer, you've gone through some of these things before with your family and sports. But really, it was all serendipitous for us to be able to get to the Olympics this summer to watch our daughter play basketball. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of hit and miss, and maybe a lot of other people didn't know enough what to do to be able actually to get on that right track.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Well, first of all, congratulations to your daughter and to yourself for getting to London. As you said, it's as much a family commitment as it is a just for the athlete. But I couldn't agree more with you, and I think that that's our biggest problem. And to me, what upsets me is to think about all the kids that don't make it to the Olympics because they didn't end up in the right place at the right time. And that's what it's coming down to in a lot of cases, as you've just so nicely described. I think a big part of that is getting sport into the school. I think it's exposing kids to sport, to the fundamentals, so that they have an opportunity to try sports. In Canada, you know, we play hockey. And we play soccer, and not every great athlete is going to find their fit in one of those two sports. And unfortunately, around 12 or 14, we know we lose a lot of athletes who don't see that as their destination, you know, the NHL or the Olympics in soccer. So you're absolutely right. We have to do a better job to exposing kids to different sports, and I think that will trickle down to the family as well. But we absolutely have to get that introduction happening a lot earlier so that kids and parents know what Olympic sports are out there and they know how to participate in them.
Maybe a nice way to end this up. Other thoughts on the role of family? Jean-Sébastien, I would imagine that a lot of the entrepreneurs you're dealing with are leaning quite heavily on family in the early stages of startup.
I only talked about the good parts, right? With all these principles and stuff, but I didn't always live my life that way. I was actually very bad with family early on. When I started my first two companies, I missed the first 2 years of the life of my first two kids. And, these are some of the only regrets that I have in my life. So I think I try to teach the entrepreneurs I work with today not to do that. But it's very difficult because you're passionate about something. You live in a world that is extremely competitive where, and I'm sure this applies to sports as well, probably even more. I mean, you compete with countries like China where, you know, the people are like machines and you have no choice if you're an athlete but to work out all the time, you know, towards that gold medal. Now, in our field, it's not the same, but you know, it's extremely competitive. So what usually ends up happening is, you know, the entrepreneur will sacrifice some things on the personal side, and but the families will usually support them. And in some ways, it's in those times that you know whether the people that surround you are really the right people.
Well, unfortunately, our time for this first panel has come to an end. I want to thank the audience for some great questions, but particularly I want to thank our four panelists, Jean-Sébastien, Beatrice, Jennifer, and Tammy Emma. And I think they've given all of you a picture into what people who are extraordinarily successful in their fields go through in that early stage of career, having to be pretty determined to see a fourth place Olympic finish as a failure, to cold call marketing firms or production firms and deal with that kind of rejection, to travel to to weather those sacrifices on family that Jean-Sébastien just talked about. But I think also interestingly that the real sense of the communal nature of this, the need to be able to rely on others, on communities of mentors and supporters, and that gives us lots of things to think about over the next day and a half about how can we continue to build those kinds of support, strengthen that in the way forward. So I want to thank all of you, and I think I'll turn it over to Professor Straw, who will tell us about our next session. Thanks.
Well, I'd like to thank the members of this fantastic panel. And Brent, you should have your own talk show. You're one of the best moderators I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Mais je ne vais pas vous parler de la post-insertion, mais je vais vous dire qu'il y a un pause café de 15 minutes. There's a coffee break of 15 minutes. Il faut être de retour à 3h15 pile pour le début de la prochaine session.